Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I don't always do introductions to podcast episodes, but I kind of felt that this one needs it because myself and the people you're about to listen to are all old mates, and we kind of jumped into it without really explaining who's who. The genesis of this episode was the publication in 2012 of a book called The Tequila Ambassador by Thomas Estes. Thomas was a West Coast American who once visited Amsterdam in the early 1970s, fell in love with it, and decided to move over there and open Europe's first Mexican bar restaurant, Café Pacifico, in Amsterdam in 1976. He went on to co-own and operate 16 Mexican restaurants spread across six countries, as far afield as Australia. And after a couple of years, he met a gentleman called Philip Bailey. Phil Bailey, who was actually coming in to paint a mural on the wall of Café Pacifico. They became dear friends, business partners, opened all those places together, and became first unofficially and then actually officially ambassadors for tequila when that was not as popular as it is now. And very few people have done as much as Tomas and Phil to promote agave spirits of all kinds around the world. They also went on with fifth generation tequila producer Carlos Camarena to found the brand Tequila Ocho, which you see on the better back bars all around the world. In writing the book, Thomas was characteristically shy. He didn't want to put too much in it about him, but he's one of the most important people in the industry. He did want to always have another crack at it. And 5 years ago, they all started working together. They being Thomas, Phil Bailey, who you're going to hear now on the podcast, Mitch Wilson, ex-UK bartender who had edited a book on agave and photography for Phil, and Tomas's son, Jesse Estes, who works for the Tequila Ocho brand. It was a lot of work to get all these people on one podcast, and while working together on the book and digging through memories and piling through literal shoeboxes of documents, Tomas actually passed away. So the book coming out now in what's known as the VO, version originale, is a mega update. It's a completely different book, really. Twice as long, beautifully photographed and designed, well edited by Mitch with contributions from many more people. And finally, Tomas is given his rightful place centrally in this book. We had to do this at a time that would work for all of us. And since Phil was on the Gold Coast of Australia, we started at 4 p.m. New York time, which was also, I think, 5 p.m. Barbados time where Mitch was. And it was 9 p.m. in London where Jesse lives. So me, Jesse and Mitch got to raise a little glass of something to Tomas. I'm afraid that Phil had to make do with coffee. But before we embark on the whole thing, if you want to get a pen and a paper, if you still possess such things, or type it into the notes app on your phone, you can now pre-order the book. It's a truly beautiful artifact, 432 pages of pure knowledge. One man's journey to and through agave, all the rules and regulations you ever, ever want to hear. Cocktail recipes, personal essays. It's truly fantastic. And you can order it, pre-order it actually, on wonkpress.com. That's wonkpress.com. Wonkpress.com is taking pre-orders now. They will start shipping books in early April, as soon as the shipment arrives. If you are in the UK, you will be able, probably after April, to order from the Whiskey Exchange. And you'll probably be able to order from the Danish supplier Jules in the EU. But that's just taking a little bit longer to sort out. So all the details you need for whoever you want to order from are on wonkpress.com. And with that said, thanks very much for listening so far, and on with the episode. And now we're back with an agave-soaked episode of The Philip Duff Show, number two in our series of three. And we have some royalty on here to talk about the new book, The Tequila Ambassador, Jesse Estes, Mitch Wilson, and Mr. Philip Bailey. Welcome, guys.
Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Beaming in remotely from the Gold Coast of Australia, Barbados. And where? You know, I assume you're in London, Jesse, right?
Sunny London.
Sunny London. Whereabouts?
East London.
Oh, nice. Because you're hip, obviously.
My girlfriend's hip. She is way cooler than me. This is too cool of a neighborhood for me. As Mitch, I can tell, knows what I'm talking about.
You are both very cool, Jesse. Don't.
Well, chaps, I'm going to kick off with a toast, obviously, to someone whose name will be coming up quite a bit. Obviously, I'm talking about your late dad, Jesse. In fact, I was thinking, this is going to be horrendous. It's like 2.5 hours of reliving the trauma of losing your dad and a 450-page book. I hope you're okay with that.
No, man, not at all. For me, it's reliving all these beautiful memories. And I don't know, we're going to talk about this, but I can't wait to share this with the world.
Well, I'm glad to hear this. So a toast of whatever you have to hand, whatever spirit it may be.
Bit too early for me. I'm drinking coffee. But I would definitely get one for my brother a little later.
A toast to Thomas. Cheers.
Thomas.
And I'll follow it with what I always used to drink whenever we were out and about, Negro Modelo.
Mm. Very nice.
Because when I say I live in the Upper East Side, I actually live in Spanish Harlem, which is brilliant for food and drinks and whatnot. So, okay.
Fantastic.
Now, we're all old mates, and we could be doing this anyway, but it is in honor of a new project that is, I'm told, accepting pre-orders as soon as tomorrow on the various websites. The original version, as it's being titled, the second edition of a seminal book called The Tequila Ambassador, which first came out over a decade ago. And in fact, I've got one of the originals right here, nice, which now sells for something bizarre on the resale market. Do you guys know about that?
Yeah, it's totally crazy. It's if you can find it, yeah, people will charge you an obscene amount for that book because I don't know how many copies were printed. I think there were 2 or 3 runs, and I think it was maybe 6,000 copies total. And
from what I remember, it was 3,000 the first round and 1,500 the second round. And
right, that was so 4,500. Yeah, there you go.
Probably 4 years after it had run out of print, and before the second edition, it was listed on Amazon for $4,000 for a used copy. That's crazy.
This reminds me of when I used to drink bottles of Pappy Van Winkle on my own. Well, fortunately, Mrs. Duff has been a huge agave fan for a long time, and as you may know, she used to do a huge amount of work for Diageo. And when it came out, she was doing a seminar that year with Enrique de Colsa at Tales of the Cocktail. So she bought about 80 copies of the book, and everyone who came to the seminar got one.
Wow. So, wow.
Yeah, I know. And we've got a few of them knocking around. It's to give an idea to anybody who doesn't have $4,000 to buy the original book. It was very much a sort of a memoir and a how-to and a tequila explainer and a culture explainer. And the new book is over twice as long. There's lots of amazing new stuff in there. Could you tell us, how did it come about, the idea to do Tequila Ambassador, original version, as it were?
Well, I actually have been thinking about this, and originally I thought it was 2017, but in fact it was 2016. I was with Thomas. I was doing my Agave Love tour, and we were in Hong Kong finishing the tour. And I said to Tom, why don't we redo the book? Because there were things that he had hoped would have been in the book that weren't. And so I suggested, why don't we do it? And his immediate answer was, no, I don't want to do it. And then I was with him again in St. Petersburg in 2017 doing an Agave Love tour there. And I pressed him again, and he was still like, no, 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 but maybe. And then at that time, I had actually done my book, Agave Love. And so it became a little more realistic of the idea of actually doing, oh, nice, of doing a book. And that was sort of the beginning of the story, really. And then from there, he just started gathering his notes, and the project started really 2018. And then Mitch, you came in 2019 or end of 2018.
Yep.
As the editor, who was also the editor for Agave Love, and it just went on from there. So it's been a long haul.
And what would you say were, because I think part of the structure, we'll see how that holds up after a couple more beers and shots, is that we sort of go through the sections of the book. But what were the things back then in Hong Kong that Tomas kind of wished were in there that hadn't made it in for whatever reason?
It was more about his writing, the style of his writing, which was in this book is a lot more personal than the original book. And as well, which I think Mitch had a lot to do with as well, is that this version is really about Thomas's journey, whereas the first book was a very brief section about Thomas, and then everything about tequila. And one of the things that Mitch and I argued often with Thomas about was, and sorry, I don't want to talk all the time here, but one of the things we argued with him about was he would go, oh, this book is too much about me. There's too many photos of me in this book. And as Mitch and I would say to him, Tom, this is called The Tequila Ambassador. It's about you. Yeah, it's about tequila, but it's about you. And isn't that right, Mitch? It was consistent.
Yeah, it was really interesting going through the whole process, because as Phil said, I edited Agave Love for Phil, and that was the first book I've edited. And off the back of that, Phil kindly put me forward and suggested me to Tomas. And I was kind of expecting the same process. You know, I was expecting, okay, we'll go through all these documents, we'll have a look at it, we'll see how we can improve it. And for the first few months, we did that. And then by the time we got to what we felt was a you know, getting near the completion of all the material we had, I realized that there were all these holes in the story. There were all these parts that were missing. And, you know, I reread the original, and it really struck me. I was like, Tomas, you haven't written anything about yourself, you know. And he was just, he's so humble, and so, you know, he wanted to celebrate all these other amazing people he'd met in the agave world and talk about them and put the spotlight on them. And, you know, for me, I started my bar industry journey a little bit later, and a lot of these people that we take as legends and look up to in the industry, they're so already ingrained in that position that sometimes we forget to ask, how did you get there? Like, how did you open up the first Cafe Pacifico in the 1970s? Like, what was that like? How did you start Tequila Ocho? You know, all of these questions, which I guess Tomas, you know, taken for granted. And I really wanted to make sure that we got down in this book. And so then from year two, that really began the whole rewrite of filling in all these gaps and interviewing Tomas and really making sure that all these stories were captured.
I mean, I think it literally reminds me of talking to Tomas on many an occasion, except when we spoke Dutch. He spoke possibly the worst Dutch that anyone has ever learned, fluently and confidently. But we sometimes have the odd session in Dutch, and I was fortunate enough to see Pacifico back in the day. And, you know, I still walk past the building where it is on a regular basis. But I learned a lot from this. But, I mean, obviously, by the time you rolled along, Jesse, you grew up in Paris, right?
I was born and raised in Paris, yeah. And then eventually went to high school in the U.S.
Oh, really? Was French your first language, or did you kind of grow up with a bit of both?
French and English both, yeah.
And how was sort of like the link to Amsterdam? Did you like go often or not really, or only when you were 16 and wanted to get wasted, or?
as I was very begrudgingly reminded on a regular basis, I was conceived in Amsterdam. So I suppose I have some roots somehow in Amsterdam. But no, we'd go at least once a year that I can remember growing up when I was in Paris, and I was just there a few months ago, and have a strong affinity, as I think everyone on this call does. I think everyone on this call besides me has lived there. But yeah, great city.
Yeah, that's true. Great. Actually, Phil's journey predated mine, and people still ask me, so where do you live now? And I've been in New York for 12 years. I'm not quite sure how, but not to get ahead of the book. Tomas literally went to Amsterdam, liked what he saw, went back and saved for 4 years and opened Cafe Pacifico, the first Mexican restaurant in Europe in 1976. Like, quite apart from the balls on that guy, what a different time. Like, so much less rules and regulations, even though there was some regulatory issues with Pacifico in the early days. Like, what a world.
It's incredible. Yeah, and it was one of the things that really struck me when we dig into this book and asking him, you know, like, well, did you know how to open a bar? Did you know how to make all these drinks? And he's like, no, I just figured it out. Like, what? Like, it's
that's
hard.
What? Well, in the book, you tease out, Mitch, although you, Phil, will know. Like Thomas said, he had no idea how to make drinks, no. Right? So he presumably went and as we've all done, you go and buy a cocktail book. Back then, I can guarantee you most of them were shit because they're copied from other shit books. So how did he learn to make a decent margarita, et cetera, et cetera?
By drinking them. And in fact, one thing that Tom and I did when I came on the scene, that wasn't until like 79, was to go to as many places as we could and focus on the margarita. And we would go to some of the best bars in the world and have the worst margaritas. We could go to some of the shittiest places in the world and have the most amazing margaritas. So it was really all came down to fresh produce.
But where would you go to learn? Like Mexico, the US?
We'd go to Mexico, we'd go to Paris, we would go to London, we would go to Germany, we'd go anywhere. I mean, anywhere we were. And obviously, you know, in Mexico it was a no-brainer, but it was just anywhere that we could, we would see margarita on the list and we would ask for it. And the weird thing was, most people had never, I mean, the demand in Europe for margaritas was so small that people just had a recipe book. They'd never tasted a real margarita. They didn't know what reference point was. So they'd just go, well, this is what the ingredients say. There you go. And it'll either be too sweet or too sour. It was just disgusting. And in fact, what the original Amsterdam margarita came down to before it spread to London and Paris was using fresh lemon, because limes were rare as hen's teeth, and triple sec. I remember trying probably 15 different types of triple sec to find the right balance with lemon and triple sec and tequila. And it was Sauza Silver, that was the house tequila, bang. And it was that thing of making it both sweet and sour at the same time. So basically, when you take that first sip, before you put it down, you already want to take another sip.
A proven business model. And there's one page in the book, which is the, you know, the family of Pacifico, because it's uncharacteristically restrained. But this place must have been wildly successful. It spawned a branch of 16, right? It's kind of like an almost Forrest Gump thing. This guy who doesn't know how to cook the food or make the drinks not just opens the first Mexican restaurant, but it expands to 16, which surprised even me. So,
and not only in six different countries, it's, you know, the logistics on that. It's like you got a problem in one venue. It's not like you just jump in the car and drive there. You got to go to another country.
Yeah, I mean, I owned one bar and I was done. I can't imagine this. So what was it like when it really took off, Phil? Like how what was the engine of setting up this mini empire?
So Tom was he had this incredible ability to manage people. and to get people, he would give people ownership, not just financially or whatever, but he would give them ownership of their job, like me. Mm. I mean, I started working and he just said, go for it. And then he would come in and he would say, well, you know, how about this and that? And we would work together rather than him saying, you do this. He would give me the opportunity to actually express myself, which made a huge difference in the whole journey. So I think his skill was in finding the right people, putting them together and making teams. And when I first discovered Amsterdam in 79, that's when I first started working with Pacifico, they had like 4-hour queues out the front of the restaurant, people just waiting. And then people would get to the bar, and it's like you first walk in, the bar's on your left. People would wait at the bar, and they would get so hammered waiting for a table. By the time they got to the table, it was like, I remember there was one classic story. This guy, he was so drunk, he got to the table, he ordered his enchiladas, and he had his elbows on the table, and he just went, boom, and just collapsed. And we called it the enchilada nosedive. It was like,
yeah, sorry about that.
I mean, other examples, there's photos of it somewhere in some of the earlier books we did for the company. But, you know, there's one scene in the middle of the restaurant, middle of service, and there's Thomas on the floor wrestling two girls. And I remember this customer sitting there and going, Dutch guy, and he's going, isn't someone going to do something? And I just go, no, that's fine. He's the boss. It's like, it was absolutely madness. And another night I remember there was a Swedish girl who ended up working in Paris, and she came in with three South African guys. It was summer, really hot, and there was very little ventilation in the restaurant. And they were sitting on the back table, and the three guys took their shirts off. She's going, well, hell, so can I. So she is sitting topless, and all the customers are going, what the hell is going on? It was that sort of place. It was very, what Thomas would call freestyle, not hostile.
And when the group expanded, like, did investors come in, or like, how were they able to replicate it 60 times on different continents and all?
So I think Jim helped a lot because his brother was a banker, and they managed to get investors that, you know, the first venue in Amsterdam just became so successful. It proved itself as a formula. And then they really focused on location, location, location. So I think with London, when they first set up in Covent Garden, you know, we went in there and it was a ghost town. There was nothing there. It was like really, but it was close enough to everything. It was close to public transport that they could actually secure a venue which was big, open, and had that sort of domestic, or what do you call it, industrial vibe, because it was an old banana warehouse. And then suddenly the garden built around it, really.
Mm.
And the same with Paris. Paris, it was 50 Boulevard Montparnasse. So instead of being the right side, which is where Le Clos and all those other, you know, ritzy restaurants, it was 50 meters the other way. But it's still really close walking distance to Montparnasse, the metro station. So it was always in a location which was not mainstream, which also made it a little more interesting for people as well, because it was like Amsterdam. It was a little dangerous, but it was safe as hell because it was right opposite the police station.
Well, it's a filter for the interesting people. If they're willing to walk a little further, that's nice. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, I know where you had your first nice Mexican food, Phil. And Jesse, I think we could just like skip you on this because you probably grew up in the kitchen. But like, I did not grow up in a place famed for its Mexican food, or indeed for any food. And my first tasty Mexican food, my recollections are a little hazy because I've been drinking for decades, but it might well have been Pacifico in London when I lived in London. What about you, Mitch? Like, the first time you had good Mexican food, you knew it was good.
Yeah, I grew up in Southend-on-Sea in Essex, so the only Mexican place we had was called El Pancho's, where they wore the giant hats. And
brilliant.
That did not count. So yeah, for me, it was it would have been Pacifico or maybe even up above Pacifico, where they used to have
El Nivel. Yeah.
Well, and I think the first time I met Tomás was at Rebecca Dooley's London sessions, where she did a session, funnily enough, launching the first version of Tequila Ambassador. And my mentor, Jim Wrigley, took me along and said, oh, you need to see this guy and hear what he has to say. And that was the first time I met Tomás and tried good Mexican food all in the same day.
Well, that's quite a day. But I mean, imagine importing, you know, nixtamalized corn to Europe and trying to explain what it is, and God forbid, trying to get hold of tequila. You know, like it's just mind-boggling. Like what a mindset.
Well, in the book, you will see there's a letter sent from Javier Sauza complimenting Tomás and Café Pacifico on their work in, you know, spreading Mexican food and culture. But I remember in the early days of Amsterdam, when Genie was there, for example, and they first started, you couldn't buy tortillas. So they were actually grinding their own corn and making tortillas individually with like a little hand tortilla machine. And then as the business grew bigger, we actually Tom imported a proper gas tortilleria machine. And it was in the basement of the house we're living in Brouwersgracht. And so it would be wake up in the morning and all you can smell is this fresh tortillas coming up through up the staircase. But it was crazy because no one was doing it. And then, in fact, what was great was that it was a nightmare to do, but that set the precedence. And then we had people say, okay, well, we'll make you tortillas. So they started doing it. And when the quality went down, we said, well, sorry, you know, not good enough, we went back to making our own. And then they go, oh, we've just lost all that business. So they improved to meet our demands. So he really set a precedence in that way.
It's all normal stuff now, but that degree of obsessiveness was not how people ran restaurants, with the possible exception of the French and the Spanish back then. It's mind-boggling.
Even now in Amsterdam, you know, there's so many restaurants you see, you know, and the Argentinian steakhouses, and you know, they couldn't point out Argentina on a map. You know, it's like this idea of authenticity 50 years ago is incredible. You know, when as you say, no one would have even known what the right thing tastes like, but Tomás knew, and because Tomás knew, he had to do it the right way, and you know, I think if anything speaks to his character and his dedication to the business, it's those little moments like that you see pop up again and again and again.
Well, I think for people who don't know Amsterdam, there the parallel universe is a little bit linked to the whole Argentinian steakhouses in Amsterdam thing, because I'm sure you all know the founder of the group that would become Gauchos was this like Israeli backpacker, and he'd been traveling around the world and he saw the quality of Argentinian steaks, and they just improved the quality of vacuum packing them. So he set up a little steakhouse, and he was the first person, certainly in Holland, to import vacuum packed steaks. And they were so much better, it killed it. And that was the basis for the Gauchos group and for everyone else to copy him. And the guy, I think his name is Zev. I think he's still alive. He lives in the UK.
Zev Godic, it was.
Yeah. Amazing.
We set up some Mexican restaurants for Zeth in Den Haag, in Harlem, and in Utrecht. We set up three of them for him.
It's wild to think that these two pioneers were knocking around in the same area.
Yeah.
You know, neither of them from Holland. But then again, none of us are either. We've all been there a good bit. Well, Jesse, let me just jump in and ask you a question here. Well, two questions. One, there's a photo of some kind of a qualification certificate in Shotokan karate in the book. Does that ring a bell for anybody?
Phil's nodding. I don't know what that is.
Do you know what it is, Mitch? Do you, Phil?
Yeah, that was something that Tom got from Ensenada or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
I think it was Ensenada. And in all honesty, I think it was like you could just go and buy this stuff and they would do more than actually being a karate expert. We had all this random stuff because I became the art director for the group. So my job was collecting all of this stuff to use, you know, for decor in the restaurants. But yeah, he wasn't a karate expert, but it sure looked good.
It would have been fascinating if it was, because Shotokan's the style that I did. I know it really, really well. And I was like, well, this goes a total different way.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, Shotokan and Goju together. So we'll have to have a spa sometime for that.
Anytime, mate. So, Jesse, I wanted to ask you, did you, I'm sure there was never any pressure to join the family business, but when did you start to even like let it percolate and think about like, oh, I might do this one day, whether the restaurants or Ocho or whatever?
Yeah, good question. It was never an intention of mine initially. I kind of got into the industry more through Henry and Dre, Henry Besant, the late Henry Besant, who mm-hmm. we all dearly miss, obviously, and Dre Masso. At the time, it was the Worldwide Cocktail Club, and they kind of took me under their wing and showed me the ropes. And I couldn't believe that I could get paid for working behind the bar. I just thought it was great. And so I did that for the first part of my kind of working life, my career. And then it came a point where my dad said, you know, we're looking to hire someone for Tequila Ocho. It was kind of when the brand was transitioning from being what I would call a hobby with no single full-time employee for the first several years. And then, you know, they started to take it a bit more seriously, Steve Tischler and my dad, our business partner. Mm-hmm. And so they said, you know, do you want to come work with us? And at the time I was working for Marriott Group in a, you know, corporate environment, and it just sounded great. So that I've been with Ocho or with the restaurant group in some capacity for, gosh, how long has it been now? Over 10 years, I guess.
10 crazy years.
It must be interesting to learn to get to know about your dad through other people. Right. And also, as you get older, it's like the old joke. I thought my dad was an idiot when I was 18. By the time I was 28, I was amazed at how much he'd learned in the intervening 10 years. But of course, as you get older, you literally approach the maturity and knowledge level of your dad. But, you know, I think we can all agree he was a special unicorn, a true really after reading the new edition. I really feel that I know him a lot better, and he was a real beatnik. There's no other word for it.
Mm-hmm. Beat is the word. Beat. He was definitely beat.
I think Phil, you described him as like hippie meets beat, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting point as well with his writing style, because that was one of the biggest things which struck me and talking about you know, what he wanted in this version of the book versus what came through in the last. And, you know, the last edition was edited perfectly grammatically, but that's not how Thomas wrote. And it's not how Thomas spoke. You know, when we went back to the original writings that Thomas had, you know, you could tell he wanted to be Jack Kerouac. He wanted to be one of the Beats, and that was his writing style. And so, you know, when I was editing this version, I was very conscious of, you know, that the idea isn't always to get it exactly right or exactly perfect as we would think grammatically, but how do you make it sound like him? How do you make it sound like one of these beat writers telling you a story on this side of the bar? And hopefully that's what comes across.
Well, in fact, Mitch, on that, you did an incredible job, because I remember when I first approached Tom about doing it, and he actually said, okay, we'll do it. And he started gathering all of his original writings and notes. And Mitch is saying, well, send me your stuff. It's like he sent this, I don't know, like a huge amount of notes and papers and stuff, totally disorganized. And then from that, Mitch had to try and decipher what he could use and what he couldn't. But then it was also that thing of there was all these gaps, as you were mentioning, where we did the series of interviews with Thomas to fill in those gaps. So you had to basically marry his written word with his spoken word, which was a real art, which I thought was incredibly successful. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, I think that's something to highlight is that, you know, when people hold this in their hands, it's a heavy book, right? I've got it in my hands now. It's a heavy book. It's a weapon, but, you know, it's even knowing, you know, 400 plus pages and feeling that weight, I don't think, and this is the beauty of what Mitch has achieved, Mitch and Phil and everyone involved in the project, but I think Mitch editing especially, was that I don't think people will realize how much work went into this and you know, years and like Phil said, you know, just imagine Mitch getting this huge stack of papers of completely disorganized and kind of creating something that flows beautifully and that kind of makes sense.
It is a beautiful thing. And I can exclusively reveal here on the Philip Duff Show that I was in touch with the publisher, Matt Pietrick, just this afternoon, and the PR company, Harry, at Rachel Harrison Communications here in New York City, where serious people live. And it will be going live tomorrow for pre-order on wonkpress.com. That's WONKPRESS.com. Wonkpress.com. In the UK, you'll be able to pre-order on Whiskey Exchange or not. And there'll also be shipping for the rest of the EU from Jules Engerbro. For people in the USA, or if you've got a mate in the USA, they'll be starting to mail out the actual physical books in early April. So go to wonkpress.com to find out where you should order it and how it should go. For anyone who doesn't know, Matt Pietrick is a complete lunatic. Like many people, a refugee from the tech industry. And when he had a problem with a technical program issue, he would, in his saying, rip it down to the studs. He'd go right back down to the basic code. And he has decided to devote his life to spirits and cocktails, especially rum. And his previous book was Modern Caribbean Rum. I think mine is the only house in the world that has the original Tequila Ambassador, Phil's book Agave Love, and the 852-page Modern Caribbean Rum, which is useful for fending off burglars, and which actually won Best New Book at Tales of the Cocktail last year, despite costing $100. And only being available from his website. So Matt is the absolute most perfect person to bring this book to life. And Mitch and Jesse are fortunate enough to have physical copies, you lucky devils. And soon you will be able to as well at wonkpress.com. That's WONKPRESS.com. Pre-orders will be live by the time you're listening to this. So,
yeah. And pre-orders are discounted, I'm told, as well. So it'll be a lower price ordering before it's actually out in April.
Yeah. Use code DUFF20 for an indeterminate amount off. Actually, there's no discount at all. Get a little bottle of Geneva with the book. That's all. Yeah. So the first part of the book deals with Pacifico. And if we were to have any structure at all, we'd move on to talking about Ocho Tequila, right? Which was a thing starting in 2008. So we've now got several generations of bartenders who've kind of always known it's around. It's very interesting to see the way it's perceived in Europe versus the USA versus Australia. Very exciting to see where it's going now. But do you remember when things were kicking off with Ocho, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I was still, I guess, was I still in high school? I mean, I was right around that time, maybe just finishing high school. But yeah, I remember those days well. And, you know, this for those of the listeners that haven't heard the story, it was Carlos Camarena, who's the master distiller and our partner in the brand, and my dad, who had been good friends for years. And it was Carlos's idea for the two of them to create a brand together. And you know, there's a much longer story, obviously, behind that. But that's how what we now know as Tequila Ocho was born.
Yeah, and obviously, it was easy enough in the sense that if there's 16 bars and restaurants, no matter what, you can usually get rid of the bottles there. But it has endured to become one of the most beloved brands. It's constantly on, you know, the trending list, and the sales are on the way up. But how was it in the early days of Ocho from your perspective, Phil?
Well, I was the first one to import it into Australia, and I was with it right from the beginning. But one of the things I wanted to say, which makes Ocho so unique to other brands, is that Thomas doesn't make tequila. Carlos does. And Carlos, so you have a distiller approaching someone who doesn't to make a tequila together. And that for me is a really unique point of Ocho. And that's where Tom's idea came of, well, if we're going to make a tequila, how do we make it different from the other tequilas that you already make? And Tom's experience, or his passion for wine, and I think it was Bourgogne that he used to go to every year, to the Nouvelle, what's it called? The Beaujolais, is it?
Beaujolais.
Yeah. No, he'd go to Burgundy every year do the en plein mer tastings.
For like 21 years, I think. And so he.
Something like that, yeah.
And so he actually bought that concept because he was saying, well, you got a premier cru here, and 1 meter away is a grand cru. What's the difference? So it was basing it on terroir and the obvious difference between valley tequilas and highland tequilas. So he wanted to introduce that, or, you know, put that concept to Carlos, and Carlos going, well, oh, I don't know, it may not work. But they did it anyway, and it was a huge success and changed the whole concept of what tequila could be.
I mean, that was unthinkable in 2008, because tequila then was not where it is now. Mm. It's mind-boggling, but to be honest, it does fit a pattern for Tomas. And with Carlos is a gifted communicator, of course, but perhaps his genius is knowing what he's the best at. We all know, in all spirits, the world is full of amazing products. It's not full of people who know how to sell them. Nobody was drinking Jägermeister before Sidney Frank. One of the greatest spirits marketing geniuses ever, Michel Roux, who was actually French, and had created Absolut, really everything you know about it, modernized Grand Marnier, rejuvenated Scully, created Bombay Sapphire. He actually turned down the opportunity to be involved with Grey Goose. He's like, no one's ever going to drink French vodka. So this is perhaps Carlos's most incredible move, because he knew that Tomas could sell it, not just in the bars and restaurants, but engender a passion together with many other people like yourselves and Julio Bermejo and David Suro and many, many people in the pantheon. But let's be clear, like any little brand, and I own a brand that makes Ocho look like a titan. If you think tequila's tough, try Geneva. It was, you know, up and down in the beginning, yeah, and finding distributors and investing and stuff like that. Even today in New York, bartenders speak lovingly of the period 6 years ago when they could get Ocho Reposado. Now they're lucky. Mm-hmm. They tell stories like, oh, I once saw a bottle of the Plata. That will change with the new distillery, of course. But I'm very interested to talk about the Corrado, which came along much later in the story, right?
Yep.
Well, Phil, you might remember, I think the first batch of Corrado was 11 or 12, right? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, according to my own very casual researching, 20, yeah, that's about right.
Somewhere in the middle there. So that again, you know, if Ocho started as a hobby, this was even kind of more of a side hobby. And this was born from the idea that actually, like Phil said, one of Ocho's main USPs is that it's the world's first single field tequila. So really delving into this concept of terroir that's now, as we all know, is a buzzword in many spirits categories and especially tequila at the moment. So they were way ahead of their time on that. But the main thing my dad wanted to do, besides even creating the first truly terroir-driven tequila, was to have the most agave-forward, the most agave-driven tequila possible. So that was the number one goal with Ocho, and that's actually where the name comes from. So Carlos tried all these different production methods, and they did this blind tasting. All of the tasting glasses were just numbered, and Carlos and my father both chose sample number 8 as having the most agave flavor. So hence, Muestra Número 8, sample number 8, being the full name of the tequila. So then Curado was a natural next step. And Phil, I'll let you fill this in afterwards, because I know you know a lot of the back story. If you go back to the 70s, my dad was drinking, according to him, was drinking in a place with my uncle, his brother, in London. I think it was called Nikita's, a Russian place. And they were infusing their vodkas. So they would have a bottle of vodka with, I don't know, lemon peel or coffee beans or whatever, chili in it, which, you know, now we have rotavaps and things like that. But back then that was probably, you know, somewhat cutting edge, at least. And he thought, you know, why don't I do the same with tequilas? So for years, they infused, even until we closed La Perla in 2016, we still had those original curados, which were tequilas infused with, you know, vanilla pods, or so all natural, though, not artificial. So kind of flavored, naturally flavored tequilas. So then my dad goes, well, the natural next step, we've created this 100% agave tequila, Tequila Ocho, that's so full of agave flavor. How do we push that boundary even more? And so they took Blanco tequila, which at the time was Tequila Ocho, and then infused it in that same way, right? Instead of using vanilla pods or cinnamon sticks, they're using pieces of cooked agave straight out of the oven. And so the Blanco tequila takes on the color from the agave, takes on the aroma, and a little bit of the sweetness, and of course the flavor of cooked agave. So to me, opening a bottle of Curado is the closest thing someone who's never been to Mexico can really experience, as if you were opening an oven of freshly cooked agaves. That's my experience around this product.
And we would call it 108% agave. One of the things with that, in fact, which is really quite unique, is that when they presented it to the CRT, it's actually classed as a Blanco tequila, because it's all agave. There is nothing else added, which is really bizarre. It's not a Reposado, it's a Blanco tequila. One of the things as well, like you said, I mean, I remember in the 70s, we had vanilla, we had chili, we had lemon, and we had, was it anise? I think it was. Mm. These were incredibly popular, really, really beautiful tequilas. But yeah, this whole thing of being Blanco tequila, adding this, and Tom was actually hoping it could actually be the perfect margarita mix. And all you need to do is add fresh lime, and you have a margarita, but it never worked that way. But the concept was amazing. It was delicious. And I've still got a couple of bottles of the very first and the second, which actually didn't say Curado, it said Ocho.
Well, hang on to those, Phil, because as I've learned from this book, when you get something, buy two and stick one away. Like, I don't have a retirement fund. I don't know about you.
Julio's suggestion on this is you buy three. Because you buy one to drink and one to put away, and then that time when you're really drunk and you crack that other bottle, you've still got one, which is a backup.
Excellent. That's wise advice from San Francisco. Cheers, Julio. But Yeah, Corrado is obviously tequila HD, as it were, and it does have some historical roots. But it was what? Acquired by the Spanish company Vantcard, or they handle international distribution, or what exactly happens?
So Curado, yeah, actually, you bring up a good point around the name. Curado is a traditional beverage, let's say, pulque, which has been in, it's as far as archaeologists know, is the oldest alcoholic beverage of the Americas, right, dating back thousands of years. And pulque on its own, I actually really like it, but it's an acquired taste. It's quite lactic. It's quite sour. It's, you know, it's this fermented beverage that's kind of 4 or 5% alcohol. Again, I really like it. It's an acquired taste, though. So what many people serve is something called curado, which is infused or flavored pulques. And again, you can find, you go to a pulqueria in Mexico, you find a wide range of flavors. And that's how people tend or have tended to drink it in recent history. So in terms of our partners, so we kind of decided at some point we wanted to do a bit more with the brand. It really was just kind of something we were doing as really on the side as a hobby. And so we partnered with a company called Vantcard, as you mentioned, who are based in Spain. They had a brand called Gin Mare, which was quite well known, is quite well known now with Brown-Forman. So that's a partnership, a joint venture with the guys in Spain.
And is there like shared ownership or something like that, or?
Yeah. It's a 50-50 partnership.
Brilliant. It's because something. Using
agaves as well. Right? They're using.
Yeah. So
they're doing tequila and Weber.
Yeah, so this is a good point. We were only using cooked blue agave to start with. And then eventually we got this crazy idea to use the same tequila as a base. So it's 100% agave tequila produced by law from blue agave to, blue agave variety. And then infusing with other varieties. So sourcing Espadín from Oaxaca, sourcing Cupreata from Michoacán, that's been cooked there in the traditional method. So in both those places, it's pit roasted. So a bit of that smokiness comes through on the infusion as well. So it's just a kind of crazy innovation within the tequila world.
Well, I think it's fantastic, and I want to ask Mitch a question. So there's so much fascinating stuff going on. This is referenced, the Corrado. You know, the Ocho journey, very honestly, says, you know, sometimes we took on investors and we went out of stock and, you know, we had to get extra money. And then the brand was acquired by the American company, Samson & Surrey, in 2020, which itself, in a very American move, was gobbled up by the mega Heaven Hill company only about a year or a year and a half ago. So when you were putting this together, Mitch, as the editor, editing is so much work, and it is something I have a huge amount of respect for. But to reiterate, it's so much work. By the way, this is why I don't edit this podcast. If you ever ask me to edit something out, I'll say yes, but I won't do it. So Mitch, when it came to things around the sort of edges of business, what was sort of like your guiding light?
For me, it really, I was quite lucky, I guess, in that Jesse was our main point of contact with everything book-wise after Tomas passed. And obviously when things like this were with Heaven Hill and others were going on. And to be honest, my one point of focus was making sure Tomas's voice came through. There was no, I suppose something like this. Now you bring it up, you would think, yeah, you would have some brand involvement, or you'd have like, you know, a company trying to guide what was being said and what wasn't being said. But that really wasn't this project at all. You know, this really was going back to Tomas's journals, hours and hours and hours of interviews that Phil and I did with him over the course of the year and a half of lockdown, which was, you know, as much as it was a terrible thing for this book, it really gave us the time to spend together and talk about everything and get these stories down. So it really was independent of all of it, even though it told the story of Ocho and how it was created and how it came to be. This is all Tomás.
Can I just mention something there as well? We were really fortunate to, I take that as a yes. We were really fortunate that we could actually get Tomás's input into the book, not just in his words or his story, but also in the design as well, before he passed. So we got his whole story down, and the only part we hadn't really been able to finish was the production of tequila. So we were really fortunate to have that time during COVID where he could actually share that whole journey right up until he passed. And we were just, we'd be Zooming with him every week and just getting that recorded down. And it was, we were very fortunate.
Well, it's a fantastic book because it teaches you everything you really need to know about tequila, but it also teaches you about somebody's journey there. Can you guys still hear me, by the way?
Yep.
Okay, excellent. Hang on a sec. Something weird just happened in the sense that one of the screens on my laptop has buggered off. But okay, I'm now looking at a blank screen. But it shows one person's journey. More than one person. It's not just Tomás. But people's journeys with tequila and the culture, and that it's inescapable from the culture. And that's probably something that we could apply to every single category, right? And to some degree, we don't really. Like, one part of that disconnection, if you'll just indulge me by following along for a moment, is that many of the world's best-selling spirits, most popular spirits, aren't popular in their own country. Irish whiskey exists and survived only because of the French company Pernod Ricard and the American and English companies Seagram's and Diageo. Cognac exists because of exports. Like, famously, very, very, very few French people drink cognac. It's like 95% an export product. England's has drunk a lot of gin, but it still exports more. So what I'm trying to say is that other people are kind of looking in from outside and saying, oh, France, that's cute. Or, oh, Ireland, lovely, I'll drink Irish whiskey. Whereas the local people aren't really doing it. Like, you were the first person in this Zoom to go to Mexico back in the day, Phil. What was the relationship of the people that you met to tequila, and maybe more importantly, to mezcal or other things back then in the 70s?
I remember in my first trip actually to Mexico was 1980, and I would go to bars with friends and they would say, oh, what do you want to drink? And I'd say, well, I want tequila. And they would look at me like I was crazy because for them, they didn't drink tequila. And mezcal was even less appreciated. It was like mezcal was really the poor man's drink. So unless you were in the region of tequila amongst producers, then they would, obviously tequila was popular. But outside of that, it was Presidente brandy was the biggest selling spirit in Mexico.
And then still is, no?
Huh?
It still is, no?
Still huge. And then Bacardi rum, which is also made in Mexico. And then Scotch whiskey. So they were the three big spirits. And tequila did not exist. In fact, I remember Francisco Henal, who was the founder of the Tequila Academy in Mexico and the master distiller for Cuervo. I don't know if he still is or not. But I remember him telling Tom and I that it was through Mexicans coming to London and their friends saying, oh, you're Mexican, you have to come to Cafe Pacifico and drink tequila. And they go, no, we don't drink tequila. They actually learned an appreciation for tequila in Cafe Pacifico, London, and took that back to Mexico. And so it wasn't till really like the mid-90s where tequila became popular in Mexico. And then mezcal, that wasn't really until, what, 2000s, mid-2000s. And then it just took on, became huge. And it took on like a national, you know, image of a spirit. This is our spirit and only our spirit.
Well, this actually has a Southern Hemisphere name, what you've just described, Phil. It's called Crowded House Syndrome. The New Zealand band Crowded House were, you know, popular band and definitely New Zealand. But nobody was, you know, very vocal about, oh, I love Crowded House, until they got a number one in the UK. And then everyone in New Zealand was like, well, I fucking love this shit. And that's what's behind all of this. Like, bartenders from Amsterdam go to London and New York and they see Old Duff at the Connaught or Patent Pending or the Chelsea Hotel. And they go home and they think, well, maybe Geneva isn't terrible. And this is something that's played out in so many other spirit categories. Like the reason, for instance, that Calvados and Armagnac aren't at the level of their cognac brothers and sisters is because they've almost never had foreign ownership. It's a fascinating thing. Well, look, let's take a little diversion here. We're talking about tequila. I've got some experts on this Zoom. One of the questions that's out there, and I don't even have all the information, is did the Spanish bring distilling to Mexico? Or was it prior to the Spanish, Filipinos, who, you know, in their turn had been colonized by the Spanish, but they brought the distilling knowledge to Mexico earlier. What's your feeling, chaps?
That's a big question, and I think it's very hard to prove because there's a belief that distillation was happening pre-Columbian times, but they don't – well, if there was, it was so minimal and the influence was so small that it wasn't something – to actually make, you know, there's no real proof of it. There's a lot of theories about it. So I think it's 50-50, the Spanish and the Filipinos, because the Filipinos were brought to Colima, I believe, to start growing coconut plantations. Mm-hmm. And with them, they brought the knowledge of the Filipino still for distilling coconut. And then when they outlawed that, then they were obviously employing local indigenous Mexicans in that, and they learnt the process and they took that back up the river valleys when the, you know, it became prohibited or prohibition came in and started using agave. And that's the story I understand anyway.
It makes sense. I mean, have either of you guys heard anything separate, different, interesting?
I think the official history is that Spaniards, you know, the Spaniards brought distillation technology with them. But, you know, I think the jury's out on that, whether it came from that side, the Atlantic, or whether it came from the Pacific, or whether people in Mesoamerica developed their own distillation technologies. And, you know, I just think on some level as well, the Spanish destroyed so much of that culture when they, quote unquote, conquered Mesoamerica, that it is really hard to find those artifacts kind of left over that could prove anything one way or another.
Well, speaking of historical artifacts, one of my favorite expanded pieces in the new one, the new edition compared to the previous one, is, you know, the maestros, the people who made really important changes. And one of them is the couple Robert and Marilyn Denton, who, you know, not everybody know. I haven't met Bob. I've spoken to him on the phone. But a major player, having previously helped introduce Kettle One Vodka to the USA and some single malt whiskeys, he introduced Chinaco Tequila. Now, not the first 100% blue agave tequila in America, but they did it in a way that nobody had done before. They took it to, you know, gourmet food festivals. They sampled it in tasting glasses without the brand that they later created, El Tesoro, with Carlos Camarena. Its acquisition by Jim Beam, now Beam Suntory, really opened the door for a lot of people because it was a really big bet, a similar bet to the one that Paul Walsh made, the former CEO of Diageo, with Don Julio. Don Julio was not any kind of a certain bet for an international drinks company. Like, that was mega. Did you ever think, when all this stuff was happening, Phil, that, okay, maybe a big firm's going to pick up the ball and run with it? Did you ever think, like, yeah, this is it? Or was it just like... Well, no, with Chinaco, with El Tesoro, you know, these early movers, even with the early Patron.
Well, I think the whole thing with tequila was it was a beet drink. It was really like it was the bad boy spirit of all the spirits. So it never really had that corporate image attached to it. And I think that was the attraction for a lot of people, was to drink tequila. And, you know, I mean, you drink tequila and things happen. And not necessarily the things you want, but that's the image that it has. Plus, there was also the battle of false tequilas. A lot of false tequilas were on the market, which were not produced in Mexico. I mean, we used to have them here in Australia. No agave, absolutely zero agave, high in methanol. And you drink this stuff and it gives you a hangover from hell. Yeah, you know, I mean, seriously, it's like drinking, I don't know what, but meth. It's the stuff that people go, I can't drink tequila because it makes me sick. Well, there's two points on that. One is that it's such poor quality and it's full of all these impurities. Or the other thing is that everyone's drinking, you know, Bloody Marys, or they're drinking, you know, gin tonics and whiskey. And then at the end of the night, they go, hey, let's do tequila shots. You know, worst thing you can ever do. Because it's one of those spirits that, for me, doesn't really mix with other spirits, except maybe beer. So I think the image of tequila, yep, perfect. I think the image of tequila never, for me, wasn't an obvious corporate spirit of going, you know, like looking at Patron or whatever. It's, you know, it's just gone ballistic.
But you saw that happening.
Oh, totally.
Phil. And, like, did you have any thoughts at the time? Did you think, oh, this is great for tequila? Or, oh, you know, in the words of a book written by somebody that we know, are the gringos stealing tequila and they're going to fuck it up?
Yeah, I really didn't expect it. And mind you, I was just, I mean, my knowledge of tequila, my knowledge of Mexico was non-existent before I met Thomas. And in fact, when I first started working with Thomas, it was to paint a mural on a wall. It had nothing to do with bar or anything. So, you know, it was through my connection with Thomas that I discovered the Mexican artists, Orozco and Diego Rivera and whatever, and then discovered tequila and then realized actually tequila is a good drink. So he actually carried me under his wing to expose me to the better side of Mexico. But the idea that tequila would become such a huge spirit, no, I wasn't prepared for that. And unfortunately, I should have been, because maybe I could have jumped on the bandwagon and made a shitload of money. But I'm quite happy the way things are.
Some brave people in big companies made some very big bets. So let me open question for everybody. And it's relevant to the book. Obviously, tequila was very beat. And the idea of being a connoisseur for tequila was even more beat than that, right? Mm. Now, I live in New York City. There is an entire cohort of 26-year-olds who don't just live in Brooklyn. They live in Bushwick, which is the new Brooklyn. And their first agave was mezcal. They don't even drink tequila. They probably never have. Tequila is what their boring parents drink. So, coming up behind that is, of course, mezcal. And coming up behind that is ricea and bacanora and pox and even non-agave things like sotol. So everything's possible. But what's going to happen with these? Let's say agave, or rather tequila adjacent products.
I don't think they can really compete, but once again, I was wrong. I think tequila will always be the accessible spirit which everyone can actually drink. And I mean, it's like single malt. Not everyone can enjoy single malt because it's a complex flavor, and not everyone has a complex palate.
So, what do you reckon, Jesse? I mean, you live in London, where things go fast.
To me, it's almost like if you're comparing tequila and other agave, well, most other agave spirits. Let's take mezcal, for instance. You mentioned mezcal. It's almost like lager and ale. Beer drinkers generally like both lager and ale. But just in terms of actual consumption, if you're going to sit down and drink 10 beers, which, I mean, I don't drink beer, but, you know, I suppose one could sit down and drink 10 beers. I would assume usually it would be mostly lager rather than sitting down and drinking 10 heavier ales. So that would be my comparison. I mean, the tequila category is still about 50 times the size of mezcal. So just in terms of scale, there's that. But look, I mean, I think there's, you know, this kind of conglomerization of spirits is going to continue. And I think this is global. I don't think this is just happening in Mexico or happening in the agave world. I think we're seeing this everywhere, right?
Yeah, I mean, several years ago, Glenfiddich was the first single malt brand to pass the million case brand. That means 12 million bottles a year. And only 2 years after Glenfiddich, Glenlivet did it, right? And they haven't compromised their production methods at all. They're not allowed to, because there's extremely strict regulations. And there's extremely strict regulations in Mexico. The CRT and CNIC. Would you like to know what one of the predictions from the original book was?
Yeah, let's hear it.
So in an interview with Tomas, one of the questions was, what would you like to see happen in the future? And lots of things had happened when that book came out more than a decade ago. There'd been the writer's trip to Mexico, and various people had gone there, and there was any amount of East London bartenders strolling down agave fields wearing cowboy hats. And what Tomas said was, I think the promotional role of the CNIT should be formalized. It shouldn't be just something they do ad hoc, right? It should be more like the BNIC for cognac, or the BNIA for Armagnac. And if I'm not mistaken, that actually hasn't come to pass, or no?
Phil?
I have no... my focus since they made me a mezcal ambassador has been really about mezcal. And I have limited connection now with tequila, because for me, it's just become too big. So I couldn't...
I don't think it has, but actually... perhaps people don't know that you're now the mezcal ambassador. Just returning to the earlier question, right? Mezcal now occupies the cool kid beat poet space that tequila used to, right? Tequila in Europe, and certainly in Australia, I feel, is still quite cool and edgy. But in America, it's completely soccer mom, you know, Houston margaritas on the rocks. So, you know, what's snapping at Mezcal's heels? There's no reason why Mezcal couldn't get to the scale that it's at. Except, of course, I think that Mezcal production is difficult to scale in a way that tequila wasn't. What's your feeling, Phil?
Well, and I actually resigned from being Mezcal ambassador because they had all this political upheaval between all the different bodies that were meant to regulate it. And now, instead of being the CRT, the CRM, there's now four different bodies that regulate mezcal production. But I think I just got your question. What did you ask me?
What I'm saying is, can mezcal become as big as tequila? And what about the other agave spirits that are also putting their hand up and saying, hey, what about me?
Well, one example on that is that tequila, I think, and Jesse, maybe you can help me on this. There's about, say, 250 tequila distilleries in Mexico.
I think it's 180 or something like that. I can't remember. But yeah, somewhere in that ballpark.
It's say 200. And they are producing how much tequila? I mean, like millions and millions and millions of gallons or liters of tequila per year. Mezcal, my last information on that was there was about 1,000 distilleries or palenques or vinatas or whatever you want to call it, producing like a tiny, tiny amount in comparison, probably a tenth of that scale. Mind you, it's growing fast. And the reason for that is because their production size is, you know, the size of a tequila still could be 2,000, 5,000 liters, you know, pretty standard. Whereas mezcal is on average probably a couple of hundred liters. And in some cases with our, you know, ancestral, it's probably 50 or 80 liters. So the amount of volume they can produce is tiny in comparison. So if you look at Pernod Ricard, for example, they have expanded their San Luis del Rio facility from being, I think it was 4 stills to now 15, still the same size and doing exactly the same as what Patron has done. They've just not made it bigger. They've just made lots of them and still doing the same process. So I think the process of mezcal, if it's, and the biggest category of mezcal that is produced is artisanal as opposed to industrial or ancestral, I think it's going to be hard for it to ever achieve what tequila has become, or maybe in 20 years or something. I mean, they have the space. It's like more than 500,000 square kilometers of, that's the DO of mezcal, and they've got agaves, but it's more the thing of the producers. And will it? I don't know. I can't see it getting to the scale because tequila hasn't stopped growing.
Yeah, I wouldn't want mezcal to get that big. I think it would, in the nicest way possible, I think it would kind of ruin what's special about the category now.
Well, in fact, one of the things I feel is, as an ambassador, I'm almost sort of, I kick myself for having promoted it as much as I have, because it's like, I think the beauty of it is being small and intimate and, you know, it's something, it's a special spirit which should be respected. Like they say, you know, you don't drink mezcal, you kiss mezcal. You know, it's that's the approach you should have to it. It's not to get drunk and abuse it.
Well, that idea comes out both through the book, through to the amazing construction that Mitch has imposed on, and your own book, Phil, Agave Love. But let's touch the third rail of the spirits industry, as it were. You know, there's an uncomfortable relationship between Mexico and the rest of the world when it comes to tequila and mezcal and sotol and bacanora and all of this. And it can sometimes manifest itself in like white saviorism, right? It's the aforementioned hipster bartenders wearing cowboy boots and cowboy hats walking down fields of agaves, or, you know, the photo of somebody playing at being a jemador for 5 minutes when these people do it all fucking day. I once went to a distillery and the jemadors had lunch with us and they were just nice, big, quiet chaps. And I remember looking at them and I could imagine, I kind of fantasized their conversation. They're like, I don't mind the long hours. I don't mind the burning sun. I don't mind the physical labor. But now I have to have lunch with these assholes from New York and London and Sydney, right? So there's something there in what you said, Phil. Like, do you want your mezcal distiller to have a Testarossa, right, and a NetJet subscription? If the stuff is well made and it's artisanally, ancestrally made, I think there's a nasty thing in that we want, on some level, the Mezcal distillers to be poverty stricken, right? It's something unconscious and a little bit unpleasant. When tequila was the beat thing, it was Mexico is this wild place. But now everybody has been to, like, Tulum is essentially Williamsburg, Brooklyn, south, right? If you want a good time, go to Acamal. You know, everyone's been to Cancun. Everyone's been to Puerto Vallarta. The cruise ships stop in, you know, Cozumel. I don't know. I kind of want to put it out there and just get some reactions from you chaps about that, because it's a bunch of white guys standing around talking about what's best for Mexican spirits, right? There's something a bit like that, right?
Well, in fact, on that, I mean, I really want to see those producers, the quality of their life improving. I want to see their, but the thing is, are they getting that? Are they getting those just rewards? Or is it other people that are not Mexican who are making a lot of money off the back of these people who are still living a very simple, you know, they're farmers basically, or?
Yeah.
And how do we improve their life so they've got clean water, they've got, you know, a comfortable environment and the chance to improve, but still not destroying the spirit?
Well, Mitch, as someone who's, you know, you came in really at the top of the fucking market, frankly. Like, you know, the first time you have great Mexican food, the first time you meet Tomas, the first time all that. We can't be going in nation building, right? It didn't work for America in Afghanistan. They built a bubble, which was rudely ruptured, right? Mexico is, it's, you know, an amazing, beautiful country. But it's, you know, it's very nice to build the odd school or something. But from the background of and the perspective of somebody from Southend, what's your feeling? Because you're up to date with what's going on in the big cities everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I defer, obviously, anything agave-wise to Phil and Jesse, and everything I learned from was from these guys and Tomas. But, you know, I work in the rum world, and that's very much my ballpark. And, you know, we've had our fair share of white saviorism and obviously colonization and everything else in between. And it is a delicate balance to get, you know, I don't think anyone here wants ever to see anyone in poverty or hardship. I think there's a fine line, which a friend of mine, Chucky Tom, pointed out really well with her sort of narrative on tiki culture, especially in the States. And it's that division between cultural appreciation versus cultural appropriation. You know, are you taking something, you know, giving them nothing and making all the money yourself? Or are you finding a way to elevate their platform? Are you finding a way to invest that money back into the communities that make this amazing spirit? And, you know, the rising tide raises all ships, because, yeah, you know, there might be an element where someone on the outside has that platform. We've already talked about how tequila grew because of its success abroad, and then that's come back to Mexico. You know, I have no doubt that that will have a knock-on effect with mezcal, sotol, these other spirits. You know, the bartenders or the nerds in any category are always at the cutting edge of wanting the geekiest, weirdest, most abstract thing, the flavors that the average person cannot handle. It's absolutely true in the rum world as well. And, you know, I think they, you know, it is these bartenders and these enthusiasts who go out and they share this knowledge, and hopefully, you know, the right things happen, the right people meet, the right connections are made, and the communities making these amazing spirits also benefit from it. But obviously that's not always the case. And I think it's one of the biggest things we can all do when we're buying brands or spirits or choosing the spirits we put in our bars is to ask these difficult questions and say, you know, what do you give back? What are you doing with the communities? Like, is there, you know, and not just for show, but is there any connection, or is there a way that you can do that?
Yeah. I mean, what's your take, Jesse? This has been something that's been part of your life for over a decade.
Well, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that's coming more into the forefront, there's all, you know, there's all these kind of trends in let's say tequila, for instance. Additive free, for example, is a big movement now. People wanting to know more transparency around the tequilas they're drinking or the spirits they're drinking in general. And I think ownership will be something that people start looking at next. I think, you know, Mitch just touched on that, and I think that's a really important point. And so that'll be interesting to see. But that would be for me a logical next step.
Yeah, I mean, the general thing is that the value is added up the supply chain, right? If you're a distiller, you sell your product, and that's the only profit you're going to make, right? And you'll sell it to a company, and then they'll sell it to a distributor, and the distributor sells it to a bar or a restaurant, and everybody adds 30%. Everybody's participating in capitalism. But not every country is perhaps as well run, right? In America, fine country. Me and the missus are going to leave in a few years, but please don't kick me out if you happen to be listening, anybody from the government. There aren't enough rules for capitalism, right? It could frankly do with a bit more of a level playing pitch. If you look at a Netherlands or a Sweden, they've got more rules. And it fucking rocks. It's fantastic. It's still capitalism. It's still the same thing. So I feel that that's an issue all around the world. And also, I think you said the word farmer, Phil. I grew up in a tiny little village of 5,000 people near Dublin. My first ever job was picking potatoes. And I'm here to tell you that farming is shit, right? It's so hard. And you are prone to commodity price swings. You're not selling a finished product, right? There's many people who can make mezcal or bacanora or tequila in Mexico. There aren't many people who know how to sell it. So the John Paul DeJorias and the Thomas Esteses and the Carlos Camarenas and the Robert Dentons, they're geniuses. And I was delighted to see a friend of mine included very prominently in the book, which is, of course, Miguel Sedeno. He was in the previous edition, and I really think he's like the distiller's distiller. I don't know if you guys want to explain a little bit who he is for our listeners.
Phil, you want to get this one?
Miguel Sedeno used to be the master distiller for
Herradura.
Herradura. Very humble man, very knowledgeable man. And he left Herradura. He went to the CNIT or CRT. I think it was the CRT.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
But just a really incredibly pure, humble man with an amazing knowledge and a good heart. And, I mean, I can't really say more than that, except that he really knew distillation and he used to make wonderful products.
He set up the training program for distillers, and he helped set up the certification program.
So very, very influential, but it's someone that probably no one knows about.
He's too shy. I did a seminar with him once, and I tried to get him to talk shit about other people or brands, and I just couldn't do it. I'm like, what's the stupidest project you worked on? And he said, well, there was one with like chili peppers. But he is the very definition of a gentleman.
Yeah. Very, very nice man. And so good to have him included in the book.
Did you have like calls or Zooms with him, Mitch?
Not with Miguel, I don't think. But a lot of Tomas's notes referred to him, and he had a lot of reference points. You could clearly see that Miguel, I think, was a mentor to Tomas, or certainly was someone that Tomas clearly looked up to.
Definitely that. Yeah, I was emailing Miguel, and so I collected his updated his story. And one thing we tried to do with the interviews was focus on updating what we could and what we couldn't. So there were some people who were in the first book that aren't in the second book. But we tried to upgrade that whole section so people who have the first book are not repeating the same, you know, we're not repeating the same story for them.
I think that succeeded. Well, let's keep on touching third rails. Diffusers. Now, they're out there. They exist. I think the question for many people is, A, do you have one or not? And B, to what extent do you use it? Because a diffuser could be used on a basic level just to rip up the agaves, but it could also be used to extract a vast amount of fermentable sugars, which could be good or bad. Let's go, I don't know, we'll start with Jesse. What the hell? Diffusers, what do you reckon?
Well, I think I'll stay in keeping with the kind of essence of the book, which is very much inclusive of all tequila brands. So I think I'll keep my opinion about diffusers to myself. But what I will say is what I respect a great deal in any producer of anything really is transparency. So if you use a diffuser to produce your tequila, you use 100%, you know, diffuser production process, and you're proud of it, and you welcome people to come see your distillery and see the whole process, I've got a great amount of respect for that.
Hey, man, couldn't have put it better. What do you reckon, Mitch?
This was a funny book, part of the book, actually, because as Phil mentioned, by the time we got to the production section, was around the time when Thomas passed. And of course, it was the one section of the book which I could edit, but I had nowhere near the level of technical expertise or knowledge in the agave world to double check everything and verify everything and make sure it was right. So, you know, I was on calls with Phil and Jesse, and we lined up countless meetings with some real luminaries and experts in the agave world, because I thought it's so important we get this production section right, because if it's anything like the rum world, every single tequila nerd out there is going to read it, pick it apart with a tooth comb, like anything that's wrong or becomes outdated in the next few months, we've got to jump on. And the section of diffusers from the original book said something like, diffusers are this new technology in the tequila industry that, you know, a couple of people have. And it's like, I don't think that's right, is it? you see the growth of it over the years and how much more widespread diffuser technology is now. So in terms of opinions on it, as Jesse said, I think transparency is everything. You know, you should know what you're drinking. It's a big message we have in the rum world as well. Just drink what you like, but know what you're drinking. And hopefully for anyone who's reading the book, they will not find too many, if any, errors in that production section, because we had help from some amazing people who are in the acknowledgement section of the book.
Well, I mean, if someone's got a diffuser, you never know the extent to which they're using it. I mean, what do you reckon, Phil?
Well, just back to what Mitch was saying, Thomas passed away, and we were just starting on the production section. And the information we had from Thomas, from his original book, was totally out of date. So it took us more than a year just to update that production section, to just find the right people, get the right information and update. So as Mitch says, hopefully it is as up-to-date and accurate as possible. But my original feeling towards diffusers was very much like, oh, I don't know, I think diffusers are really bad. And they're using diffusers in mezcal production. And it wasn't until I was an ambassador, I actually saw how mezcal using diffuser actually has a really positive point, because it uses so little agave to produce so much product. So it actually is protecting those other agaves or those other mezcals, which are more unique or limited or you know, they're more a scarce production, or, you know, supply, basically. So a lot of people, and I'm thinking more of mezcal here, there's this huge boom, let's drink mezcal. Everyone wants to drink mezcal. Not everyone wants to drink mezcal because, oh my God, it's mezcal and they're really interested. They're drinking it because it's cool and trendy and hip. By using a diffuser, you are protecting the rest of the market by having just a pretty ordinary, well, in comparison, I think, to artisanal or ancestral, a regular mezcal, which is going to everyone's cocktails, and they don't really want to drink mezcal directly. They're just drinking it mixed with all this other stuff, and you're not really tasting the mezcal. So For me, I go, yes, the diffuser has its place, and I think it's good for the industry to protect the other part of the industry.
You know, I love that answer, because one of the debates, because I'm a very contrary person, that I love having with Julio Bermejo is when he revolutionized the drinks program at Tommy's, he went, you know, 100% blue agave, which was difficult and unusual back then. Now, tequila is so big that agave shortages are a real thing. People are using unripe agaves. And I've said to him before, it's like, okay, maybe we need good mixto tequila. Because historically, that's what it always was. We have a precedent with blended whiskey. Like blended whiskey, blended scotch far outsells everything else. Before the Scots started blending whiskey, their malt whiskey was shit. Irish whiskey, like, dominated. And they just found out a way, as you say, Phil, to stretch it. Like the classic ratio was 70% 100% blue agave, and then 30% of some kind of sugarcane spirit. And specifically on mezcal, what I'm seeing now in the US is blends of rare agave types on a base of espadine. So 20 or 30% cupriata, and then maybe 70% espadine, which is far more widespread. What do we think about that?
And sustainable.
Yeah. And it is getting the product out there at a price that people like. But it's so much labor to produce a bottle of tequila. It's so much labor to produce a bottle of mezcal. Something I asked Danielle Tataran, somebody that some of you will know, was what should we pay? Like in New York City, I can get a bottle of the excellent Siesta Misterios Dolby Edge for about $37, right? And I can get Del Maguey Vida for about the same thing. And I can get the aforementioned La Luna or Crania for that. But it doesn't seem to reflect the work of the people in Mexico. Is that a long-term problem that we're sort of covering up?
Well, I think Ron Cooper was a great one of helping to set a price in relation to quality, or you know, I mean, it set a price of mezcal is not cheap to produce. You should be paying for it, which for me helps protect and give respect to the category, as opposed to, you know, bottom shelf, bottom price, you know, bargain basement mezcal, which is super cheap. I don't think that helps tequila or mezcal by putting them on the market.
Yeah, if you think, and it's similar to the rum world, which, you know, I do quite a lot of work in myself. This stuff has come from around the world. It's been made by people just like you doing serious labor. Obviously, the vagaries of capitalism are, you know, the market decides, the invisible hand of the market. But you should also, for a very well-made product, be happy to spend a little more. And it's not a lot more, is it? Like Ocho in a cocktail, a shot of Ocho compared to something else, you're talking about literally just a couple of dollars, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think even in the US, it's people have money and people don't mind spending money on something that they perceive as being premium or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I think I kind of agree with Phil that, you know, really a race to the bottom, actually in any category, but especially in agave spirits, really doesn't help anyone.
I mean, you see it in everyone's going for that house pour because they can sell volume and they just keep undercutting and undercutting. But the agave spirits are one of, well, I believe some of the most labor-intensive spirits in the world. The time it takes to grow them and looking after them, nurturing them, and then harvesting them, and then just the whole production process is incredibly time-consuming and labor-intensive.
Yeah, and it's something that can be forgotten if you're not aware of, you know, the supply chain that you're in. Just as people are like, well, you know, I'd rather not buy chocolate that was made with child slave labor in West Africa. It's more like, okay, I'll pay a couple of bucks more. We've got some certification now. Generally, I think the regulatory bodies in Mexico are excellent, but the new thing is additive free, right? And two of the people who founded that, the Tequila Matchmaker couple, are in the book. And I think additive free is going to be taken up by the Mexican government. It's a really good certification. What do you think additive free is going to look like in 10 years? Is it going to become the new bio or organic for agave spirits?
Anybody?
I was leaving it too, Phil, but yeah, I think so interestingly, like you said, organic, I don't think organic really took off in the tequila category. So yeah, I think additive free is not going anywhere. I don't think it'll be gone in 10 years. And again, I think it just comes back to what I said about transparency. I think increased transparency for me is a good thing in anything, I whether any product, any other spirit category. And again, nothing wrong with using spirit caramel or glycerin, you know, whatever it might be. But like Mitch said, what did you say, Mitch? Know what you drink? Know what you're drinking?
Yeah. Drink what you like, but know what you're drinking. I believe that's the Yves Barrel phrase from back in the day.
I like it.
One of the things with mezcal that probably a lot of people may not be aware of is in the original NOM, it used to be two types of mezcal. There was 100% agave mezcal and then 80% agave mezcal. Now, all mezcal has to be 100%. Hmm. That, for me, supports the idea of the diffuser, where because it's you can't have a mixed or a blended, you know, mezcal, you need to really preserve those. And one of the other things for me as well is the use of wood in pit ovens. I mean, this is raping forests in Mexico, using an autoclave, using a diffuser, once again, is protecting that finite resource. So I think there's positions for all of those different elements in the category.
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, we're just talking about tequila and mezcal, but agave spirits can be made all around the world. And I spoke about this with Tomas back in the day. I most recently spoke about it in February with Julio when he was here. And last summer, I was on a press trip in Italy, and I met a charming Indian guy who makes an agave spirit, and it's delicious. It's Indian agaves, Augustifolia, grown, milled, cooked, fermented, distilled, and aged in Goa, and it's delicious.
Yeah. So, stolen?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So this is, you know, just as whiskey used to be Irish or Scottish, and now some of the finest ones are Japanese or Taiwanese, this is a way that we're going in, isn't it?
Definitely that. I mean, they're making agave spirits here in Australia. And I mean, for me, some of the samples I've tasted have not been amazing if I compare it to some of the tequilas I've had, but it will be. You know that they're going to get it right. And for me, it's a totally valid category. I think still tequila and mezcal will be my go-to, but the agave spirits I've tasted that are not from Mexico have also been quite different as spirits. And I think part of that is in the process as well, because the process, the terroir, there's something about Mexico which for me is unique, and especially mezcal.
Well, let me ask a question to everybody generally, and I want everyone to respond. Some of the biggest news of the last few weeks was somebody I've known for quite a while, Enrique de Colsa, former master distiller of Don Julio, named as his successor by Don Julio himself. Enrique has been out of the game for a little while, and I remember being at the Barra Mexico show down in Mexico and bumping into him, and he's like, oh, can't tell you what I'm working on. And he is going to be now bringing out a tequila with the Lost Explorer brand.
The Lost Explorer, yeah.
Exactly, which is, I think, maybe even bigger in the UK and Europe than it is here in the USA. But it did flag up a question in my mind, which is a tequila brand also having a mezcal, or in the case of Lost Explorer, a mezcal brand also having a tequila under the same brand. Does it work? Is it not odd? I have kind of an emotional reaction to it, but I'd like to hear what you chaps think. Starting with Mitch. No.
I mean, from the outside looking in, I think it can only be a good thing, usually. I've got a good friend in the States who is working with Lost Explorer, and you know, he's a real champion for transparency and things being done the right way. So I kind of trust anything he's working with or associated with, he's going to be doing the right thing. I think with all brands, you know, you build up a level of trust. You see what their ethos is. You see the way they do, you know, how they do one thing is how they do everything. So if they're committed to doing authentic agave or authentic tequila or authentic mezcal, you know, chances are they're going to carry that ethos through onto their other products. So yeah, if it's a good brand and you know, you think they're making quality juice, then why not? You know, I'd be curious to taste it.
Jesse, go.
I agree that I think it's interesting. It's the first mezcal that I'm aware of for it to go in that direction. It's usually a tequila brand that starts a mezcal. But you know, it's a genius partnership. You know, Enrique has really serious roots and know-how and experience within the tequila world. So to do that again, I think it's about doing things in the right way, right? It's not about just creating a tequila for the sake of creating a tequila. Hopefully it's about doing something genuinely unique, like my dad and Carlos did. I think to me, that's what interests me, at least as a consumer. If someone's just created a brand of anything, of vodka, of mezcal, of tequila, just for the sake of creating a brand, and because, you know, maybe they think they can sell it or whatever, I find that uninteresting as a consumer.
Well, I think it comes back to Phil's thing, but I'll let Phil put his two cents in here. Mr. Bailey?
I first encountered Lost Explorer last year at the Athens Bar Show. And I was very impressed. I thought the quality of the juice, it's not cheap. The mezcals were like up there in price, but the quality was amazing. I was very impressed. I think the idea that they would do a mezcal, I'm thinking like Clase Azul did a tequila and then they're doing a mezcal. And there's a number of brands, well, mm-hmm. Casamigos, tequila mezcal. My only thing would be, what is the return for the people in Mexico out of that? But if you want to do it, I mean, Enrique is a wonderful man. I know him well. I've spent many times, you know, sharing a little tequilita with him. And I think he would do it right. So as far as production-wise, I don't see any issues with that. It's more, what is the big picture of who's getting the real benefits out of this? Is it being distributed or is it, you know, one-sided?
Well, it's interesting. And I think it comes back to the observation you made, Phil, that flows through this book, which is that, you know, tequila used to be beat. It used to be edgy. And it no longer is. And if it still is in a country over the next 5, 10 or 20 years, it will cease to be. Everybody will follow the role of the USA. It'll be what your dad drank, right? Because he was edgy 20 years ago. I don't mean your dad, Jesse. Your dad was actually edgy. But everyone who wasn't fortunate enough to have Tomas as your father. To have a tequila and a mezcal, it reminds me, my favorite Irish whiskey, apart from any of my clients, is Powers Irish Whiskey. It's fantastic. And some lunatic in the marketing department just brought out a Powers Irish Whiskey rye, which makes no sense. There is no history of rye distilling in Ireland whatsoever. It's a temperate climate. We have dolphins and killer whales off the coast. We don't need rye. And they even have ads in American magazines like Imbibe saying, bye-bye American rye, Powers rye is here. Right? So it doesn't make sense to be Powers and do a rye to me in the same way that just prima facie, it doesn't make sense to be a tequila and a mezcal as well. Doesn't mean that there aren't amazing people. Like Enrique is a huge talent. My God, I'm so glad that they caught him. Some of the mezcals are terrible. The Casamigos mezcal is horrendous. And other ones are excellent, like truly. But I'm just more concerned. It seems to be a disconnect. It seems to be you've got like one brand that appeals to 40-year-olds and one that appeals to 25-year-olds.
And then the RTD.
Yes. Canned Palomas or, you know, we've got, do you guys know about ranch water, by the way? You must know, right?
No.
No?
No, ranch water. What's that?
I know, right?
It's a Texas thing.
Okay.
Tequila, soda, and lime.
Oh.
Because the number one drink in America is vodka soda. Which I didn't believe for the first 8 years that I lived here. I thought it was a collective joke being played on me by everybody that I knew in New York. But ranch water is a thing, right? Tequila, soda, and lime. And there are at least half a dozen brands of canned ranch waters.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
They're jumping in that. I mean, you guys in the U.S. had that huge seltzer, hard seltzer craze. So, you know, to me, that's almost an extension of that. We never really worked over here. I mean, I think White Claw exists here in the U.K., but I mean, you rarely see it.
Well, it's actually, I think the hard seltzer thing in the U.S., although it's hilarious to have Jesse say to me, you guys in the U.S.
would you say 12 years? I think you're almost an adopted American by now, right?
Well, I did 17 years in Holland, so but it is no. Do you actually? I guess Phil and Mitch, you might not know. Do you guys know what LaCroix was?
Oh no, it's familiar, but I can't. Could you so need to remind me?
It was a canned fizzy water with zero sugar. And yeah. Natural, like, fruit flavorings. And my kid's 18 now. But when she was about 12 or 10, this was the shit. It was a status symbol among 10-year-olds to have this zero-sugar fizzy water. And when White Claw really got going a few years ago, I mean, it tastes identical. It's LaCroix with some utterly neutral booze. It's fermented malt beverage. However, LaCroix never really exported and never really made it abroad. So they didn't establish that beachhead upon which to build, which is why White Claw has never boomed in the UK or anywhere. Really. That's it. It's fascinating. They've also, by the way, White Claw Hard Seltzer has now brought out a non-alcoholic White Claw. So it's a non-hard, hard seltzer.
Just as expensive. Nice.
Well, yeah, exactly. Twice as expensive as sparkling water. Great.
It's genius. Like, honestly, this agave business is a racket. We should all get into the non-alcoholic hard seltzer business. It's so much better. Well, guys, we've covered a lot of ground here, but actually, I don't want to cover any more. I want the people to order the book, which you will be able to do on wonkpress.com. That's wonkpress.com. Go there for all the information about where you can pre-order it based on where you live. Books will start shipping in early April on a first-come, first-served basis. It's from the award-winning Wonk Press itself. Use the code BAILEY10. For an unidentified discount on this, that's BAYLY10. Every book comes with a small hat.
And a shot glass.
And a shot glass and a mini of mezcal. Yeah. Unless we can get Ocho to sponsor it. Guys, are we forgetting anything here?
Only that I would just
Yeah, I would just add that this is, even though it shares some part of the name of the original from 2012, this is really a new book. So, I mean, it's been rewritten, or as my dad would say, unwritten. So unedited, and then kind of, you know, Mitch has really kept that original style, again, that original version style. And a lot has been added. So I would say there's, I don't even know, Phil, what would you say, 10 to 20% maybe overlap with the original book? If very little.
This is a totally, I mean, there are some small parts in it that may be repeated, but I would say probably more than 90% all new material.
So I would just mention that.
The title actually is the Tequila Ambassador VO, which is for Version Original. So it's like how Tom originally wanted it.
Like the director's cut, kind of.
Yep. Yeah. It's an old French film term that Tomas was very into. He wanted to call it VO as a Version Original. And yeah, the original writings of it all. And yeah, I guess I just really hope that, you know, for everyone who knew Tomas, for everyone who got to share a tequila with him and learn from him, I hope this book does it justice, you know, and does him justice and really, you know, gives you some extra stories and some extra insights into this mentor and this hero we all looked up to in the agave world.
And it's also, let's be clear, an amazing way to learn about agave spirits of all kinds. It's got the rules and regulations. It's got the noms. It covers the runners and riders of some of the people who laid the important groundwork in the start of this second cocktail golden age decades ago. You see the evolution of one man, but also his friends, what Carlos Camarena looked like without a mustache. I mean, this is a marvelous book, and right now Matt Pietrick and Wonk Press are absolutely knocking it out of the park. So I'm going to go around my panel one more time. I'm not going to do the usual thing where I ask where people can find you online. Look in the show notes. There'll be Phil and Mitch and Jesse's Instagrams and websites, and also the link to buy this. I just want to ask you where you're going to be drinking your next agave drink in a bar, and when? We'll start with Phil here.
It'll be Sanchez, Señor Sanchez in Sydney, which is a new bar opened by the guys from the Maybe Group. They've got Maybe. They've opened a really cool Mexican place on Oxford Street in Sydney. Super cool, make amazing drinks, and they got a great range.
Beautiful. What about you, Mitch? I mean, I'm not sure what the tequila scene's like in Barbados.
One other place I do need to mention is the Palomino Lounge with an amazing mezcal selection in Enmore, Newtown. Very cool, brand new bar.
In Sydney. Opened.
In Sydney.
Palomino Lounge. Bingo. So how's the agave scene in Barbados, which has famously one road going around the island?
I haven't found any tequila ocho here, so I might be on the run for a few more weeks my little Caribbean tour here. But I'll be hitting the States straight after this trip, and hopefully we'll be doing a couple of little launch events for the Tequila Ambassador book, where I'll be teaming up with Jesse and Phil in various countries. So that'll be the main time. So details to follow on that, but certainly something stateside and in the UK coming soon. So
top notch, Mr. Estes.
I'll be in Cafe Pacifico, London, obviously tomorrow, and always a good place for a tequila or a mezcal or any agave spirit these days, actually. So 42 years is quite a bit older than I am. It's been there. So anyone in London, stop by, say hello.
It's still crazy to me, but even having edited the book and even going through all these stories of how it all started, it's still crazy to me that a bar in London has survived that long and is still the heartbeat of agave in the city. It's a testament. The fact you can read these stories and you can still go and drink in that bar today is amazing.
Well,
touch wood.
If you're going to be reading this book, make sure you have a tequila in hand.
Exactly. Well said. There you go.
One for you and one for Tomas.
Absolutely.
Well, that's it, guys. One more toast. Tomas,
cheers, guys.
Everybody who has helped. Cheers.
Yeah.
Salud.
And on that note, cheers, everybody.